This is Barry Wynn here. I'm a sometime author, and because of my age, which is no secret, I'm 87, I was at a very formative time in my life when the Second World War began in 1939, when I was in fact 10 years old. My father had joined up in 1939, and we didn't see him for about 4 years. So before he left, he took his family down to Devon, where he thought it would be safe, and it was only 23 miles from Plymouth, and I actually watched Plymouth on fire when all the oil tanks were hit by the Germans. So I didn't see my father for a long time, and eventually he was in the Royal Army Ordnance Corps, and he became Assistant Director of Supplies for Montgomery when he was made the operation commander under Alexander for the 8th Army.
Tell us a bit about Montgomery. Was he seen as a bit of a new broom at the time?
Well, there are one or two very interesting things, I think, about that situation. In North Africa, we had some brilliant generals, Wavell, Allenby, and people like that, but lack of supplies, everything difficult, huge areas to cover, and they needed, Churchill needed, and guided by Alan Brooke, needed a new team out there, because we were basically in a very powerless state from morale. Everybody was depressed, been beaten many times, but they were pretty brilliant in what they did, because they didn't have enough men and didn't have the right equipment. And the German equipment was far superior to ours. So Churchill, on the advice from his military people, said, we've got to have a new team. They decided to appoint Alexander as the GOC, and they, in fact, then appointed a man called Gott to be the field commander. But he was killed within 3 weeks of being appointed. So there was another crisis. Who on earth do we replace that key position? And Allenbrooke said, there is one man we've got to do. There's only one man to do this, Montgomery. Now, the interesting thing to me, because after all, I was very young then, was that the two commanders now appointed had both been battalion commanders in the First World War. They knew better than anybody else what we were up against with the German army. More efficient, ruthless in their way, and that something special would be needed to do this. And Montgomery said, yes, well, I will accept the task, but only on one condition. I'm not prepared to start an attack or do anything else until I am given the right number of men, the right number of units, the support of the Royal Air Force, and the supplies. And if I say I want 10,000 shells of so-and-so, I shall require 30,000. If you do that for me, I will give you victory. That's basically what he said. And Churchill said, I agree with you. Okay. That's what we would do. So my father was on the supply field. It was terrifically difficult to send all these supplies right across the Atlantic to escape from the U-boats, down the coast, the east coast of America, down through South America, then across to Africa, then up the other side of Africa. Everything had to come in this huge distance, being harassed by U-boats all the way. So the supply situation was absolutely extraordinary. And I remember in my book, A King Shilling, that my father said 500 lorry loads of food and supplies would be gone in one day to keep the army going. And thousands of miles of desert highways, Stuka bombers and heaven knows what. And of course, the Battle of Alamein, and another very interesting thing, it was the last defence before Egypt. Now, when Alexander took over and Montgomery, Alexander was a sort of an aristocratic man, always perfectly turned out. He was the epitome of the British officer. Charming, perfectly dressed and everything else. You could underestimate him. But he would delegate everything to Montgomery. So the thing is this. Here we had the backs to the wall. There was the Suez Canal, only a few miles away. This new team comes in. Morale of the British Army was at the lowest possible ebb. We thought we were going to be defeated because Rommel, the brilliant general that he was, thought, right, we're right on top of this, break through the Suez Canal, we then get the oil, we then go further east, and we will attack the Russians from the rear through the Crimea. That would have been fatal. So we had to be, they had to be stopped at the last point. So when Montgomery came, he didn't choose that position. The position was already chosen. But when Alexander went into the headquarters of Africa, he saw all his key officers, brigadiers, colonels and generals and one thing and another, working on papers and this and that, and they were furious intent. And he sort of, big new broom, said, well, what are you working on? They said, well, we're working on for when we're going to go the other side of the Suez Canal and use that as our last defence. Alexander said, gentlemen, tear up those papers. There is no further defeat. There is no further retreat. We will stand here and die if it's necessary. Do you understand? Well, within 3 weeks, they say, the whole morale of the Eighth Army changed. It was the right thing to do at the time. So, in other words, no more retreat. A wonderful position we were in. Now, how do we deal with this? How do we defeat Rommel? And that is really what happened. And the main thing was the equipment and the supplies. The wonderful people we had there. I mean, we talk now about Scotland. The most wonderful fighting men to have beside you. You don't have to worry whether they'd still be there. The New Zealanders were excellent, and the Australians, and the Indians. We were all there, but now everybody knew. Right, apparently this is the end, so we better damn well do something about it. And that, to me, is a... You know, I still think, I mean, it wasn't the biggest battle by long chalk. I mean, the Russians took far more trouble. They had, you know, battles with 3,000 tanks at a time. I mean, dreadful things. But the pivotal change, really, was Alamein. And it was the last battle in which we didn't have the Americans. We did it as the British Empire. And, of course, it was successful. And Churchill was so nervous about it. But when they finally said, yes, we've done it, he wanted to be absolutely certain before he gave the order, ring out the bells of England.
How did they get the supplies, you're saying, round? Was it actually round Africa?
They had to go first across to America to get to miss the U-boats by going in the north, right across to America, then go down the east coast of America where we'd get protection from the American Air Force and anything else like that and their own home fleet, then cross from the South Atlantic to Africa, go past that, up to the Red Sea, and right up to Clara. It's a terrific way. My father told me that it took 3 months. Just 3 months to get there.
I wonder if we've got enough ships today to do that. I don't think so.
No, not at all. We haven't. You know, what have we got now?
Tell us a bit about your introduction to the army and your role then.
Well, I'm totally insignificant. The war had finished with victory. I had worked for 3 years in a wartime, 2 years in a wartime factory on the Great West Road. That was during the latter part of the war, when Hitler started launching the V1s and V2s. What actually happened was that our family, when my father was wounded at the Battle of Marath, and he was medically discharged, he came back. But unfortunately, he always said he had more trouble with his son and his children than he ever had with the German army. We were uncontrollable. I think he was right, probably. But anyway, he was a very kind man, but he didn't know how to deal with this people who'd never been under his control, really, since the war. And so we had a difficult relationship. But when he went back, actually it was to Harpenden in Hertfordshire, where we sort of ended up for the latter part of the war with Guardians. He then said, well, now there are two of us are looking for jobs. That's me. I'm out of discharge now. I've got to find a job. And Barry, you want to leave school? I said, I do. And he said, right. A big argument at the breakfast table. And he said, I was 15, just before 15. He said, Barry, you will go into Luton tomorrow on your bicycle. And if you can find a job within one day, you may leave school. He knew, of course, that was impossible. I said, right. So at dawn, I'm on my bicycle, no traffic in those days, no petrol, and I go to Luton. I try all the normal places that one goes to, no luck at all. I spent the whole day, I knew that the colonel from the 8th Army, X, had won the battle. And then as I was very, very tired and dispirited, no lunch or anything like that, I was starting to cycle out, and I happened to turn to the left, and I saw an old-fashioned kind of house of 200 years old, and it said, Lad Wanted. So I stopped, and I put the pedal on the bike, on the pedal on the curb, and I went in. I had to go to the very top. And on the outside was a sign with top hats, silk top hats, you see. So I went up slowly to the very top. There was a door. I knocked on the door, come in. And there were three old men, I don't think they were less than 80 each, with a table. They were sitting side by side making silk hats. Yes, lad, what do you want? And I said, I believe you've got a job, sir. Yes. Do you know what we do? I think you make hats, sir. Silk hats, lad. Would you like to make silk hats? Oh, I'd love to make silk hats, sir. They looked at me and they started talking to each other, you see. Obviously, boys were not easy to find. And eventually the oldest one said, right, well, start at 8 o'clock on Monday. £1 a week. So I was so overjoyed. I get onto my bike and I pedal the way back. And of course, when I got back to our flat there, my father was there, Davina, my sister, and my other brother and sister, they were all there looking anxiously because this was a huge moment in the family of crisis, you see. And there was my father reading the Times, pretending to read the Times, I think, you see. And when I walked in, he said, your lunch is in the oven, Barry. Oh, thank you so much. So I went to get my thing, put it down on the table. They're all looking, the family, at me, you see. I decided to play it cool because this was a total victory for me over Montgomery's chief of supplies, you see. So eventually, with no, I'm not helping in any way at all. I was very naughty, you see. And he said, are we permitted to ask you whether you've been successful in getting a job? Yes, I am. I'm starting on Monday. My father then sort of gulped and then said, and what is that job to be, may I ask? I said, I'm going to make silk hats. There was an explosion. Would have been devastating even at Alamein. The roof nearly went off the top. He said, no son of mine is ever going to go into the drapery business. What are you talking about? But he said, you've made your point. You may leave school now. And that's when I went into a wartime factory on the Great West Road and was blown up by one of Hitler's V2 rockets. So I consider myself to be one of the first victims of an intercontinental missile.
What were you doing there?
It was a factory, French factory, actually. The name isn't well known now, but they were perfumers. Coty was the name. Wonderful company. And my father had used influence with the managing director because he'd been in the retail business before the war. And he talked to them and they said, OK, well, we'll put him through every department in the factory of making perfumes, lipsticks, creams and what have you. And we'll give him a thorough training and then send him up to the head office to learn about sales and things like that. And that's what I did.
So your father didn't want you making hats, but he was fine about you making perfume?
Apparently so, yes. I think he had an eye for the girls, and therefore, you know, this took us into a rather sort of upmarket area.
Take us through that V2 experience, though, because I think at the time, although probably the general population didn't know this, certainly at the highest levels, there were worries that that there might be an atom bomb on the end of one of these V2s, because certainly at the top level at the time, Churchill was very nervous about the possibility of one of these things having an atom bomb on it, because both the Americans and the British, if I can say both, no, the Americans, the British and the Nazis had been working on the possibility of an atomic bomb.
Yeah, well, that is true. But I don't think we ever, no, never did I hear of the talk that there might be an atom bomb. That was at the top level. We knew that they were working on it, and therefore the average person didn't know anything about it. The first thing that happened were the V1s, the doodle bug that was called in those days, with a little engine on the back, very, very hit and miss sort of situation. They were the first ones. Then suddenly the rockets arrived with the doodle bug. You could hear it, and it had a rather bad morale effect in a way, but you hear pop, 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 pop. And suddenly the popping stopped. And if you could hear you'd heard the sound and then it had stopped, then you knew it was coming down fairly near you. And then there was the very, very considerable experience. But with the V2, it was totally different. You didn't hear anything. And it was an interesting thing. In our factory, because it was originally a perfume factory, but now making foot powder for American troops and various other wartime stuff, it was an interesting situation that all factories, of course, had rubberized black paint over the glass of all the windows to stop the glass splinters doing the damage that they did. And then suddenly somebody said to Churchill, why are we doing all this, all the power we're using on putting lights into factories and things like that during the daytime when there are no German aircraft left? Why are we doing it? We don't need it anymore. We don't need to be blacked out. So we better get all the paint off the windows so that we can use God's light during the day. So this was suddenly all over England. People, all the factory workers were suddenly said, get rid of all this black paint. To do that, you had to have, I can remember to this day, a tin of Pintoff was the name of the stuff, and a scraper and a brush. Now, the whole side of the factory was made of glass, and I was never late ever in my life on that thing. I loved the work, actually. And we had these three high-tiered ladders, and it was on the morning, it was 9 o'clock, and I was the first one to start climbing up the ladder. Now, the funny thing about it was that the hinges for the windows in which I was working were in the middle, and there was a clip at the top, and you opened the clip, and I got up there with my acid and the brush and the thing, which was very high up, I mean, say 20 feet up. And the first thing I did automatically, I don't even know why, but I just went with my finger to unclip the window. That was when it hit the factory next door, which was American Lincoln Motors. And it killed 300 injured, blasted everybody around, terrific blast effect. And the only window on that side that wasn't shattered was mine, because I'd unclipped it and therefore it just flicked open with a blast. No noise, never heard an explosion, but a huge rush of heat. I'd suddenly felt a huge rush of heat, and the next second I was flying, literally right across the factory. And on a sort of downward trajectory, I hit the wall and then slithered down the wall and landed on my knees, totally unhurt. So that was pretty lucky.
Amazing. So you ended up, didn't you, in working in television in the 1950s, I think. So tell us a little bit about how you got from the perfume factory to there.
Well, I had to go in the army first. So the war had ended. It was 1947 when suddenly my call-up papers came. So my father came out and I went in.
This is National Service, is it?
Yes, National Service. Conscript. And because I left school before I was 15 years old. I hadn't done school certificate or anything like that. So I just hurled into the army. When they interviewed me, they said, what do you want to be? I said, I want to be a fighter pilot. You see? And they said, oh, I see. Because we loved, they were our heroes, even in those days. Nobody was better in England than the fighter pilots, you know, the Spit and Hurricane pilots. And so I said that, what did you do in mathematics in your school certificate? I said, didn't take school certificate. What do you mean you didn't take school certificate? You don't think you could go and be a pilot without a school certificate, do you? And that was my first defeat. And then after that, I said, well, if I've got to go in the army, then I'll go in the infantry, the hard end of it. And that's where I went into, and I found myself in special forces eventually. Broke into Dover Castle with a crew one time, which was quite a feat. Actually got right into Dover Castle. And there we are. So I became in the infantry. And then we were going to Hong Kong, and on the way there we were suddenly told there's an uprising in Malaysia and Singapore. So you're no longer going to Hong Kong, you're now going straight into action, get fit, land in Singapore, and you're going straight into the jungle.
So I suppose the 1940s were a time where Britain was still trying to hang on to its empire by its fingernails, in a way.
Let me think before I answer that. I don't think we were hanging on because, of course, India had made it perfectly clear that they wanted their independence, and everybody was waking up to independence and that they wanted their own country under their own control. Yes, but, I mean, the war was so all intent to win the war. I mean, we weren't really thinking at that time about whether or not South Africa or Canada or anybody else. I don't think it was a matter of daily conversation at all. I wouldn't say so. But it was after the war had ended and the great excitement, and I remember standing outside Buckingham Palace on that night with Winston Churchill on the balcony with the King. I mean, I was there. Wonderful experience to be there. Unbelievable, actually. And then it was gradually, it was, of course, the returning troops who decided that we had enough of Winston Churchill and all his antics, you know, and it's going to be a new era, and we're going to sort of take over. And that's when he lost the election, of course, probably absolutely correct. And so it was a totally new era, and I don't think really people were really thinking so much about the colonies and what was going to happen. The battle had been won, that's the main thing, with the help of the Americans, God knows, we couldn't have done it without them. And so it was a different age. Then gradually, because the troops had thrown out Churchill, the control was being lost, and all these many, many countries decided that this was obviously the moment when they could assert their authority and try and, get their own country for themselves.
Now, you talk about the Americans, but what about the Russians? Because they lost a lot more, didn't they, in terms of men?
Absolutely, the Russians. The Russian, totally different thing. I mean, for instance, in the Russian army, if you were in the front line, they had a totally different concept for fighting. They moved their divisions. The fighting man only went forward for, say, 3 days. He was no food, very heavy overcoats. They had to sleep in the snow, no food, and they had their rifle and their ammunition, and they fought for 3 days. Then they were taken out, and a new lot came in. Totally different to our way of doing it. I mean, tough and hard, fighting a most dreadfully difficult battle. So, I mean, their casualties were enormous by comparison. Enormous. Wonderful people.
I mean, today we see the Russians apparently as still a kind of an adversary. I mean, do you think that's fair?
Well, I don't know how I would say it. The point is that Putin, an ex-KGB man, educated in that kind of police mentality, control of one thing or another, in my opinion, Yeltsin actually chose Putin. He was the right man for the moment because they were in chaos. and you needed somehow to get control back for Russia. And because of all his contacts with the KGB all around, he was able to say to them, you know, get hold of this situation. But now, in my opinion, he's got, you know, he's trying to re-establish what has changed forever. And the Russians have always wanted somebody to tell them what to do, whether it's the Tsar or anybody else. They need to be told what to do. And I think Putin is totally out of date. He won't last too long. Maybe assassinated for all we know, wouldn't surprise me. But anyway, he is in total command of that situation. But they signed their pledges, their agreements, never keep to them. So,
well, they would say the same about NATO, wouldn't they, with the expansion eastwards of NATO? Because when the Berlin Wall fell, there was a promise, apparently, from NATO to say, well, we won't expand eastwards, and of course they have done.
Yes, but when you say expand, it's not that. Don't forget, we've been reacting to the countries like Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, and places like that, where there is a portion of the population are Russian-speaking. And, of course, it's a very interesting thing for somebody like a politician to say, we are there to do so-and-so. That was our country, and we're going to take it back again. So we've actually, I mean, for instance, Putin was invited to go to NATO. He was invited to go to NATO. He was taken there and saw the whole thing. Because we wanted, you know, total cooperation. But there, what's he doing? Goes into Ukraine. Goes into the Crimea. He's already signed the agreements that they wouldn't do so.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I don't want to get too far into this, but I mean, he would say actually it's the European Union and NATO that have come into Ukraine. NATO are now in there training Ukrainian troops.
Yeah, of course, and they need to be training the otherwise Ukraine will suddenly go back.
Anyway, let's get back to you. And How did you get from the army into start working in the media then?
Yes, well, that's quite interesting. Yes, I could tell you that story actually because it's quite amusing. I was in the theatre, and one day somebody said to me casually, well, if you're really interested in television, this new medium now, which was black and white at the time, there's only one person I know who might be able to help you. He's a very nice man. His name was Leslie Mitchell, and he was the Dimbleby of the pre-war years. He did movie tone news and things like that. He was rather austere, always dressed in a three-piece suit and black and one thing and another, Brill cream on his hair and everything else, and he had a commanding voice, and he was sort of, you know, Mr. BBC on that. And so they said, see if you can get an interview with Mitchell. That's before ITV opened. So I managed to get there eventually, and it was in Ad Astra House, which was the previous headquarters of the RAF. And I went in there, and quite amazing. I went into the office. There was a chap, very well-dressed, sort of English country gentleman type, small, standing behind the desk at the elbow of Leslie Mitchell. And as I walked in, I had a quick glance round, and there was a man with a wheelbarrow going past the window outside on the scaffolding with cement. It was so totally unprepared for starting in 1 week's time, you see. And Leslie Mitchell suddenly barked at me, and what have you come to sell? And I looked at him and I said, efficiency, Mr. Mitchell. What? I said, efficiency, Mr. Mitchell. He said, what do you mean? I said, you've got a program that you're going to put on every day as from next week called Visitor of the Day. I noticed that your telephones aren't even yet connected to the wall. That's actually how I started. And I left the office with a contract for the first 3 months to provide the people for him. That's how I actually got in. And, you know, it was one thing and another. It was a wonderfully, period of time with everything up and tackling the BBC.
I suppose you must have known that this was a new medium. There was a big future for television. What was the company you were working for, and how did it develop?
Well, I was working. I got a letter. Funnily enough, I received a letter. I was very young. Lived in my little flat in Westminster, and suddenly one day a letter arrived, and it said, "I don't know whether you are presently employed, but I am the administrative director of ABC Television, you may not have heard of. If you'd be interested in a job, please contact my office and come and see us."
So you were headhunted?
I was headhunted, and actually, funny enough, not in a way like headhunting is today, with all the terribly minute background detail and everything else. What it transpired was that everything was so disorganised at that time, fighting to get ITV on the thing, and they had a problem in certain department, a real problem, and the man who was the chief of administration had a friend who was the managing director of another television company who was in charge of all the sales, and they were having lunch together, and my chap said, "I've got an awful problem in so-and-so," and this chap said, "Well, I have to sell against another man, and he usually wins. And if you've got a problem, I think that he might be the chap to do it for you." And that's how it happened. I even met him once, shook hands with him, very nice chap. And actually, I owe my total future to that one chap. And after that letter, out of the blue. But when I had my interview with this, the director of administration, his name was Ronnie Dickinson, became the head of a major advertising agency, he looked at me because he'd done his research, and he said, "Barry, I know you in the SAS, but I am not involved with private armies." In other words, he's just saying, you know, you must behave as I want you to behave in a normal way. There's no sort of outlandish thing. You deal with the situation, but deal with it properly. We don't want any trouble. I said, "I quite understand."
So what were the achievements of ABC then?
Well, there were many achievements of ABC, because we were only on television for the weekends, Saturday and Sunday, in Manchester, the North, Yorkshire and Birmingham. And our studios, in fact, were at Teddington Lock, still there now, but no longer, of course, that company. And we had the weekend franchise, which we shared with Granada in the North, very strange setup, and with ATV in London. So we were a large company because we were part of EMI, but we were the junior members of it. So we had to really be pretty good at programming. And therefore, for instance, you won't remember it, but Armchair Theatre, we took Sidney Newman, who was with the BBC, he came to us, a Canadian I think, Romanian extraction. He was a breath of fresh air in that situation. And we then had The Avengers, of course, which was a great success. And the other thing that we were pretty good at was outside broadcasts. Church services, all programmes that came within the big area of Midlands, North and Yorkshire.
The Avengers is an interesting one because it's got a lot of affection from people that remember it when it was first broadcast, but it's also got a big following amongst young people who've picked it up as almost something from the golden age of television.
Well, I had lots of problems with The Avengers in one way and another, but I was responsible. I'm not saying in a boasting way at all, but my staff, shall we put it that way, were responsible for launching it. And it was, of course, new leather, clad girls, and as a sort of an opposite situation, you had the impeccable Patrick McNee with his bowler hat and his beautiful suits and his umbrella with which he dealt with all the difficult people he had to deal with. And he, in fact, had been in motor torpedo boats in the war and fought with Scott against the German E-boats. So he was a very suave, laid-back chap in his own personality. Years later, this is just a little sideline, I was going to America, and I had been responsible. In fact, I started up the merchandising concepts for ABC. When I started it off, it didn't make very much money, but we were gradually getting it under control. So when I was over in Hollywood, I rang up Pat and said, "Pat, I'm in town." You see, he said, "Right, let's meet for lunch." I said, "Well, thank you very much. I'd love to do that." And we went to a restaurant, and sort of opening conversation. We hadn't seen each other for 20 years. We sat down there. It was actually empty. I wasn't sure whether I was the host or the guest, but he was always very good like that. He would usually pay. And so we were talking, and he said, "Ben, I must tell you something. You know all those dreadful things you made us do with the merchandising, the photographs of the leather, and you did a fashion show in New York. You remember the one in Paris?" I said, "I'll never forget it." He said, "We'll pay a car down." That was a story in itself. But he said, "The other day," he said, "I had a brown paper envelope from London." I said, "Yes." He said, "Now, I tell you what happened." He said, "We never got paid for merchandising. And for the last series, I was interviewed by Howard Thomas, the managing director, and I was trying to pick up something to make some more money. And I said to him, 'Listen, Howard, why can't I have a share in all this merchandising that Barry makes us do?'" And he said, "Well, I think that's quite fair, yes." He said, "What do you want?" He said, "Well, I don't know, 5% or whatever it was, you see." He said, "Barry, when I opened the envelope the other day," he said, "there was a cheque for $250,000. I said to him, "Lunch is on you, Pat."
Was there quite a lot of military minds involved in the Avengers? Because it seems to almost learn something from, espionage and World War II.
No, I wouldn't say anything at all.
No. Okay. So what was the thinking behind the series? Because it's got echoes with, as I say, young people today still, yes. And it was extremely successful. It almost, you could almost say, single-handedly got people, but making, you know, made sure there was a TV in every house. Everyone wanted to watch it.
I think that probably was true. We really put a huge effort into the publicising of it, and I had a wonderful press officer. She was a New Zealand girl, lady, and she was, the education in New Zealand is very high. She was a very good writer, very good organiser, and she sat down and wrote a background of all the personnel that were going to appear in the Avengers, and she was the one that thought up the name Emma Peel, the girl with man appeal. It was her. And so they had decided roughly on the thing, and she embellished it. And I think a great deal, I mean, she's been gone a long, long time now, but a great deal of credit went to hers. And when we had a budget, I remember, for photographics, for 500, very, very little, we didn't spend much. And she came into me once and she said, "Barry, I've taken on..." I can't remember his name just in this interview straight off, but he was the number one photographer in England, you know. I said, "Good God, how much is that going to cost?" She said, £100. I said, £100? I said, "That's the budget for a month. You can't do that for £100. She said, "Barry, we've got to do it." And I said, "Okay, well, go ahead."
Now, tell us about some of your own films, because I know that you've been behind, anyway, at least several. One of which was called Count Five and Die.
Yes, well, Count Five and Die was another one of the little miracles that I've been blessed with during my life. Upon Ruchin, his name is Ernest Hecht, and his company is called Souvenir Press. He's just celebrating next week his 65 years in book publishing. He and his family escaped... I don't know if it was Austria or Czechoslovakia. I think it was Austria. And I was then in television. And I knew everybody, quite honestly. I knew most of the key people in the world at that time, from Prime Minister, anybody that we wanted to get, we usually knew how to get hold of them. And he once rang me up and he said, Barry, he said, I wonder if you can help me very kindly. There's an American colonel in London from the OSS, and they're working on a new film or something. And he said, can you possibly see if you can find him for me? Well, I said, I'll try. So I did. I found him in a little flat in Belgrave Square. And so I said, here's his telephone number to Ernest. There's his address. Bye-bye. He said, well, no, don't leave me like that. He said, I want you to go and see him. I said, what for? He said, I thought we should do a book on all this. Oh, dear God. So I went out to see him. And I said, you know, would you be interested in a book of this story? And he said, well, I think I might, but he said, I don't think they are granted to me because of the film. And so I said, let me have a look at the contract that you've got. He's a very nice chap. He was a colonel in the OSS and a treasurer. And he showed it to me, the contract, and I said, does it say anything about books in this contract? So, yes. So he said, listen, there's a board meeting of 20th Century Fox this afternoon. He said, why don't we go there? I mean, I hardly knew him. I'm a young nothing of 25 or whatever it was. So I said, well, okay. So suddenly their board meeting was on, and there's a man called Spyros Skouros, who is the chairman of 20th Century Fox. And he was sitting at the top of a big boardroom table with about 30 other people there. Being an American, this colonel didn't worry about that, just opened the door, walked in, which nobody would do in any English company, said, hi. You see, they all looked up. And he started telling them that, would anyone be interested in a book on this, you see? And all the executives said, no, no, certainly not. All these are our rights. We own everything, you see. And I had brought copies of the contract. So I said, well, I've got copies of the contract here. Could I pass them out? And I shelled them out, you see. And Spyros Skouros, who had a huge head, and I remember black glasses that went right across the top of his head, and I saw him slowly take one of these copies, you see, and he started looking. All the executives said, it's out of the question, Bill. No way. And all of a sudden, Spyros Skouros said, the boy's right. He's got the rights. Bill, if you want to do it, go ahead. And that's how I got. So I then go back with some sort of, I didn't know anything about this sort of thing. And I rang up my dear Ernest, great friend, a lifelong friend. And I said, Ernest, apparently, we can do it. He said, he'll come to the office and get a contract and get it signed. I said, yes, but what's in this? He said, then write it, and you've got 4 weeks to do it in. I said, don't be ridiculous. I've never written a book in my life. I took 6 weeks because I just got the job with television, and I had to work all night for 6 weeks to do it. And I produced it. And I sent it to Ernest. He didn't write back or anything like that. The manuscript, a dreadful story of how it was all thrown together. And after about 2 weeks or 3 weeks, I thought, why haven't I heard from Ernest? I mean, I didn't think he'd like it, but what changes is he going to ask for, you see? So I rang him up. I said, Ernest, I'm so nervous, always waiting for some money from somewhere out of the blue, you see. And I said, Ernest, what do you think of the matter? He said, think of it. He said, it's at the printers. I said, good God. He said, we're off.
The film, you can still watch. It's probably not quite so easy to get hold of the book. But where does the term Count Five and Die come from?
It's when agents had a tooth with the cyanide inside it. When all else fails, they decide that it's best to go. You bite on the tooth, cyanide goes in, count five, and you've gone.
What about The One Against the Wind? How did that happen?
The One Against the Wind. Hold on a second, I've got to think about this. Yes, The One Against the Wind. How did I get onto that? All these things happen by strange roundabout ways. But I met, actually through my sister Davina, who lived in Paris, this wonderful, wonderful English woman, Mary Lindell. And she actually became really, I think I could say, my surrogate mother after many, many, many years. She was extremely difficult. She got the quadriga in the First World War, the quadriga in the Second World War. She got Russian, the Order of St. Anne or something of Russia for her bravery in the First World War when she went onto the battlefield to collect the wounded. And she served throughout the First World War as a nurse. Then by the time of the Second World War, she was living in Paris with her three children. And one of her sons, in fact, was walking along in Paris after the Germans arrived and saw a man who was perfectly obviously an Englishman standing on the corner looking rather dazed. And as they walked by, he said, "You English?" And he said, "I am." "What are you doing here?" He said, "I'm trying to escape." So he said, "Well, I better take you to my mother." And that's how she started off her her escape line, right down to Spain. And she got mostly pilots, because it was found out, it was realized in Britain, that a pilot takes roughly 2 years to train properly, if it's done really properly, send them to Canada doing all the things that they have to do. Of course, it was much down when we started losing so many of our fine pilots. But it was realized that it's better to spend £10,000 in gold coins or things like that to get an escape pilot out of France or wherever, get them back to England into a Spitfire, which Beaverbrook had, you know, made certain there were plenty of. And so the escape lines gradually built up, and in many cases, within 12 weeks of having parachuted out of their blazing plane, they were back in a seat in a Spitfire in England. Cost 10,000, if may not even cost that, but that's what it roughly cost. And she was one of them. There were many, many escape lines, of course, but she was one of the first ones. So she used to dress in her Red Cross uniform from the First World War. She, terrible French, the way she spoke it, in an English accent and all this, but absolutely arrogant, and she actually went to Stupnagel, the commander of Paris, demanding the passes, the Ausweis, to take all these little young babies across the border into free France, as it then was. And he gave it to her. And that's how she started off.
But she ended up, didn't she, in a concentration camp?
Yes, she did. Yes, and it was very miraculous she got away.
I mean, many people would say, how did she survive? But once the Germans found out that she'd been involved in some way.
She was shot, of course, in the place. She was going for her execution, and she was taken by two SS guards, and she realised that it was the end. So she thought, well, when this train gets down to a slower speed on a hill somewhere, I'm going to dash for it. And so she pretended she wasn't feeling well and she was going to be sick. And eventually she kept on acting up to these two people. And she said, "I can't with the handcuffs on. Please just undo my handcuffs so that I can go to the toilet. I'm going to be sick." And of course they fell for it. So they undid her thing, you see. So she went out of the carriage and then, probably stupidly, made a dash for the end of the carriage, where, you know, at the end of the French train there's an open piece there with a rail round, you see, to throw herself out. But when they saw that she'd taken to her heels to get away, so they took out their shots, and she was hit three times by their bullets, thrown out onto the side. The train was stopped. She telescoped her neck. She was badly, badly injured. And they took her to a Luftwaffe hospital. And in a Luftwaffe hospital was a surgeon whose son was in the Luftwaffe and her son was in the other side in England as an officer. And he put it together again, the Luftwaffe surgeon put it together again. But directly they did that, they then decided, we've got enough with this terrible, wicked woman. And we were sent to a concentration camp. That's where she landed up in Ravensbrück, where Violette Sabo, the very famous... was she Pakistan? I'm not quite sure where she was murdered there. and it was a terrible thing. She nearly didn't get away, but she worked eventually as a nurse for a German surgeon. His name was Treiter, and she hated the Germans, absolutely hated the Germans, but she worked for him as an assistant. And in the end, interestingly enough, they were all captured, of course, and he was to be tried. And when she gave her evidence to the British, they decided that he hadn't committed any crime there. He, you know, it wasn't bad, so bad. And that they would let him go to Switzerland, let him get away with it, on her evidence. But he said, no, I haven't done anything wrong. I've just done what I did. I haven't killed anybody or anything else. I've just been doing the best I can. And so he said, I'm perfectly happy to stand trial. He stood trial and was found guilty and was committed. And then he committed suicide, I think. So there was another guard in the thing, the man called Flum, who is an absolute dreadful SS man. And he thought he'd get away with it. And she was brought in as a prosecuting witness. And in the trial, he came in, and because she had just previously gone for the defence of Treiter, because she thought it was wrong, he thought that she would do the same for him. And the prosecution eventually, they asked, did you see this man ever do anything was incorrect, or whatever, however they did it, you see? And she said, yes, I did. And what did you see? I saw an old lady fall out of line, and he went across and stamped on her skull. Guilty. Hanged.
What about the modern world? Let's just bring it up to the present, because you know, the golden age of television is gone, the golden age of the film is gone. We've got these various different crises now, haven't we? We've got the Middle East seems to be regime change every 5 minutes, with West against East, a kind
never
of new
changes.
Almost a new Cold War, and also the financial problems that are right across Europe. What do you make as someone, you know, with all this experience from the past of these major problems we've got in the world today still?
Well, as ever, we have to look to our youth. But unfortunately, this is only a very personal opinion, the youth of today have become totally materialistic, really, and they think life is just a bowl of cherries. They don't realise what my father's generation did for this country in fighting that thing. And the fact that they live in peace now, certainly in our country and most of Europe, then it's quite insignificant, because they never tasted the fear that we had. I remember during the war, we were frightened to death of the arrival of the Germans. And they've lived in such easy life by comparison.
Yeah. You say they've been mollycoddled?
Well, I believe in the youth. I've always believed in the youth. We've gone through this a million times, you know, in our past. But they have to learn, and one hopes that with sort of reservations about Europe. We would all like to be in a Europe. I mean, it was Winston Churchill who first talked about passport-free Europe and all the rest of it. And it was always conceived as a marketplace of which we would be a member. Now it's become, you know, a nation state, if they could get it there. And the bureaucracy. Oh.
The other thing, of course, is that we're seeing a big gap opening up between rich and poor in Britain again, aren't we?
Yes, I think that is extraordinary. It's a phenomenon, really. I mean, this is the materialistic part of it, isn't it, really? Money is all important. And there are certain people that know how to make it. And that, you know, I'm afraid it's one of the things, greed.
We have Chancellor George Osborne. I mean, I know you live in Cyprus, so you may be not on top of what's going on in Britain, but he says he's going to balance the books, and he says to do it, we've got to spend less as a government. But that itself seems to be strangling off the economy.
Well, I don't think we strangled off the economy. I think it's worked. I think it's worked. It's very unpleasant. But if you want to make money, you've got to have the right people at the top to make it, and they've got to have the reason for doing it. I don't like it. This is the way the Americans do it.
I mean, we're sitting here in Wales today, Port Talbot Steelworks, they're now talking about the possibility of that closing. That does suggest there simply isn't the demand out there, there isn't the building going on, there isn't the need for these basic things for industry like steel.
Yes, I know. Well, I think they're totally wrong, of course. I mean, a little ridiculous thing. I do my own mending of my clothes and things like that. Needles that we used to have before the war from Sheffield Steel were so sharp at the point that, you know, if you happened to touch your fingernail with the point, it would go in and you'd bleed because it was the finest possible steel. Needles today and the cotton is rubbish and it all comes from China. What's the matter with us?
Well, it almost sounds like the 1984, you know, George Orwell's book where he talks about the cigarettes, where as if you tip the cigarette slightly, all the tobacco rolls out the end of it.
Yes, I know. It is, you know. Of course, this always moves in a cycle. It will come round. We will realise, you know, the error of our ways, I think. But I believe in the Commonwealth, actually. I think that the Commonwealth, if you look at the globe, I've just written an article about it, as a matter of fact, from, I was asked, actually, by the same publisher to go down and interview, with a possibility of doing a book, Dr. Barnes Wallace, as he then was. And so I did what I was told to do. I was still in the television world, but I sort of got onto this thing that you don't write one book. If it's a success, you've suddenly got a hell of a tax problem, and so you've got to do another one, and it sort of gets into a mad cycle that never seems to get finished off. So Ernest said, I think this is a book in Dr. Barnes Wallace. He's an amazing man. I said, oh, I don't even know who he is. He said, well, he's this and that and the rest of it. Go down and see him. I said, very well. So I went down and I found him on the old Croydon airport in a section of Nissen huts left over from the Second World War. I'm a young whippersnapper, no school certificate, don't forget. And now to be questioning this brilliant mathematician. I walked in correctly on time. Very, very nice elderly gentleman got up and said, how nice to meet you, do come in. We sat down. And I looked around the Nissen huts and I noticed something. Because I'm not a talented person, but I am an observer, that I must say. And I noticed that all the people there were girls. And I thought, well, that's strange. So we were trying to open conversation. And I said, there are no men here. He said, no, I won't work with men. I said, why is that? You see, laughing. And he said, always got something else on their mind. This was, don't forget, before the age of computers. He said, all I want is mathematical results. I put down on a piece of paper to girl number one, work this out. When you've done so, give me the answer. And I spread it out around my thing. They concentrate totally on what they're doing. And I find that I can work far better with women, young graduate mathematicians, and that's the way I work. And so a very interesting conversation came out of this. He said, do you know the name Bartholomew? I am an uneducated young man. I said, do you mean the map maker? I didn't know that. He said, yes, a mathematician. Oh, I said that. He said, have you ever thought of why the meridian of zero runs through Greenwich? Well, I said, no, not really. He said, it is because, as a mathematician, if you were to try and work out the focal point of the five continents on this planet, there is only one place that zero can go. And that goes on the line through Greenwich. Whether it's true or not, I've not the remotest idea, but that's what he told me, and I'm a student at the seat of this man. And so he said, don't forget, it's 50 years ago. He said, I cannot understand for the life of me why the aero industry, he worked for British Aircraft Corporation, are trying to do the most difficult technical thing it's possible to conceive. I said, oh, what's that, Dr. Wallace? To drive ever bigger, ever heavier aircraft ever faster through the thickest part of the atmosphere. He said, it's the most difficult thing you can possibly do. He said, 200,000 feet above us is unlimited energy force. We shouldn't be going fighting with huge weights of fuel and everything else to get into that. What we should be doing is going up slowly to counter gravity, slip it into the jet stream, and he said, we'll be able to go to Sydney in 90 minutes, including takeoff and landing. That is all I can tell you with my hand on my heart, is what he told me. Now we've got the things. And do you know something? I think he's probably right. We need little tiny things with miniaturized power force. How they do that, I don't know. But just slowly to go up there, flick it in there, and there we are. We've got all that space, unlimited fuel, get around the globe in no time at all. That's what he told me.
What about Britain today? Because, I mean, everybody was very impressed by Britain's empire, although obviously there were a lot of people around the world that came a cropper. We've just had recently the Australian universities saying actually Australia wasn't colonised, it was invaded, it was surrounded, and it was there was a genocide that went on in Australia. So there is a lot of questioning.
By Australians. You're talking about genocide.
Well, I'm talking about the original takeover. I mean, the British, for example, over in North America as well. The Native Americans, many of those were killed, and there's been a lot of genocide by the British over the centuries. Many people see us as the bullies, of the world.
To entertain us with all this? No, I don't think so. You see, in the old days of the aristocrats, the eldest son would inherit the estates, which he had to run profitably for the family. The second son had behind a job. What's he going to go into? Well, he might go into law. Then there's the third son. What are we going to do with Harry? Send him to India or send him to somewhere or another, you see. So they went out there commercially minded, not militarily minded. I was in Malaysia 2 years after the Japanese had gone out, and already control had been brought back. You know what I mean? We were probably arrogant, but basically we wanted, for the further of trade and one thing or another, a country that which was well run. None of these countries were properly run.
Well, some people would say Britain isn't very well run today.
I would agree with you.
What do you think's the future for Britain anyway?
Once again, you come back to the young people. We're a generous nation. I believe in our young people. If we set our mind to it, we can do it. But this business of just because you've got a degree, I've got two daughters, they've got their degrees. And in Cyprus, for instance, I had a conversation because I've got some friends there who have a kiosk, a cigarette kiosk. And I sit there almost every day when I go there. And one of their daughters has just got her degree. She's going to be a doctorate. She's got a doctorate and everything else in Glasgow. And we were talking, and she came back for Christmas, and we were talking there. And we were talking about the thing and money and all the rest of it, you see. And she said, I said to her, you've now got your alphabet. She looked at me, highly intelligent. I beg your pardon. I said, you've got your alphabet now. This degree has got you your alphabet. I said, this is just the beginning. You won't mean until you're 50 and a wise woman, because you will learn from experience. She said, I spent 8 years doing this. I said, darling, it's the alphabet. Now you've got to put it to work. She was very quiet and probably hated me, but nevertheless, that's what I said. I said the same to my daughters. You know, yes, you've got the degrees, wonderful. That is the start. You've now got an educated mind to know how to tackle these problems. But you've got to sort of, you know, put that to work. So I'm very optimistic in a way. But, I mean, there's so many things which are so deplorable. It is dreadful, some of the things that we see. But I suppose it's always been the same.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I can remember growing up and seeing the first homeless people on the streets of London, for example, begging, and we're seeing more and more of that today, aren't we?
We are seeing more and more of that. And it's interesting that there's so many ex-forces people amongst the people that are in jail. Now, why is that? I asked myself, why is that? The thing is that very cleverly, the forces have really offered a new family to young people. It is their family. It's the destruction of the families that we've made a mistake in. I remember when my father, he had to go into a terminal hospital for 1 year. It was a ghastly place, to be honest with you. We tried to have him at home, couldn't be done, and he went to this hospital. And it was mostly the nurses were male nurses, and many of them were Chinese. And when he passed away, I managed to get to the hospital, I think, 30 seconds before he passed. Just enough time for me to kiss his forehead. And standing there like sentinels were all these nurses, and there was a very nasty atmosphere, smell in this ward. And trying to be nice and to thank one of these Chinese boys standing there, I said, well, thank you very much. I said, what do you do with this problem in China? And he looked at me and he said, we would never allow our parents to end their lives in a place like this. Put me in my place, I mean, you know. And he meant it. We've destroyed the family. Why has that happened? I suppose because people don't believe in their religion anymore. It's destroyed the kind of the texture of life that we had, where you tried to live a good Christian life.
It's interesting, isn't it? A lot of young people say, for example, you ask them who Moses was, they might not be able to tell you.
No, but I mean, I don't think they've ever... I don't want to go into this, but why I'm here in Wales is because of the passing of my son. And I had to think for 3 or 4 weeks what to say, and I said it, and I think it all went over reasonably well. And I know that a lot of the young people have never even read the Bible. And actually, I recited the end thing, the 23rd Psalm, which I've known all my life, of course. And I said to them at the end, I don't know, I didn't say it in these words now, and I can't remember how I said it, only yesterday, but I said, I don't know how many of you have ever read the Bible, but remember that the Bible has been the best-selling book for hundreds and hundreds of years, and it still is. Now then, the philosophy... You can't beat it. You may not be able to do it because we can't do it. It's too hard, but it's yet terribly simple. So I then, because most of my audience were my sons, my grandchildren there, 11 of them, I think it was, who they've never seen me before. And I said, we will never meet again. Doesn't matter. Lovely to be with you today. It's a sad day, but it isn't a sad day. I said, as I came here, all the daffodils are out. There are lambs in the field. This is a rebirth. You've got to carry on. And I said, I don't know how many of you read the good book, and I'm not a highly religious person in a way, but I keep to my original teachings. I said, but do you know something? I said, there isn't one of you here that won't sometime face a crisis. It may be a broken love affair. It may be that you're facing an operation. And at the moment of dire stress, like before the Battle of Alamein, every officer knew that General Montgomery read a chapter of his Bible every night before he went to bed. I said, the funny thing is, you probably haven't read your Bible, but shall I tell you something? If after I've recited these words to you, you think there's something in them, and you're facing a crisis, I said, flick open your laptop, press Bible, punch in Psalm, punch in 2:3, and you can hear it, because you are carrying the Bible and every word in it every day, but you don't realize it. You may never see it, may never read it on paper, but I said, papyrus is where it started. And when I was in the army, I remember a chap in the barrack room say, there's no record of this. It's all rubbish, it's people telling stories. But then suddenly, a few years later, they find the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I took my daughters to see the Dead Sea Scrolls in Jerusalem, because I thought they should see it. I don't think they believe it or anything else. They're just, to them, it's a parchment that's stretched out in the cabinet, and they look at it. But funnily enough, the words are exactly what they are in the Bible, which is very interesting. So I think it's the, I don't know what it is. It's the lack of faith, spirituality, and I think it's very, very sad. But it's still there. I believe in the young people, and gradually they probably will come round to it and say, well, it isn't right. We've got to do something about this. And, you know, it's the way it is. We learn through our experience. I had lunch with a man called Colonel Pinto. There was a very popular BBC program called Spy Catcher. And he was a Dutchman, and he worked for the British. He told me this story, that he and his team were the people that went behind the British Army in Holland. And what they did was to get hold of all the people when the officials and everything else, put them into camps to then sort them out and find out whether there are any Nazis or people of, you know, risky character. He had a number two who had a photographic memory. He could say to him, so-and-so, so-and-so, what we know about him. And he'd be able to almost recite it off straight away. Very good number two. Anyway, the story is this man told me. They were going through the people that they were capturing at that time, and he that night went out for dinner. When he came back, it was sort of, I don't know, late in the night, 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock like that, and he went up towards the gates for his camp, where all these people were imprisoned temporarily, to check them all out before they were released. And the English sentry, who had just an ordinary rifle, was standing outside there, being harassed and having a hell of an argument and the thing with a great tall man, big man, with two girls on his arms. And when the sentry saw Colonel Pinto coming, he said, sir, sir. So Pinto walked across, a very experienced man, you see, and looked at this big chap standing there, you see. What's going on here? He said, sir, he said, this man's trying to take two of these girls from inside the camp out. I'm not allowed to let them go. And he said, and this chap stood with Schmeisser on one thing, Luger automatics on another, grenades and God knows what, you see. So Pinto looked at him and said, what's your name? And he said, King Kong. King Kong. He was boasting, of course, you see. But what his real name was Lindemann Christians. This man was a bully and very big. Pinto was not, you see. And he noticed that he had a captain's pips on his arm, on his sleeve. And when this man was threatening the colonel...
What, you mean for a British army, captain?
Yes, yes, you see. But yes, so the Dutchman, King Kong, had got his pips here on the sleeve, which of course you can't have. And so when he was trying to browbeat the colonel, he went forward and grabbed the things and pulled them off him and said, "How dare you have your pips on your sleeve?" And when he did that, the man shrunk because he was found out, you see, and he went off and the two girls were put back in again. Next morning, Pinto went into his office. This is first hand, I can tell you. Went into his office and said to this number two, "What do we know about King Kong?" "Oh," he said, "it's the famous Rezzo." Rezzo, that is a defence, a partisan gang, as it were, a Rezzo in France. And who was in this Rezzo? It was run by a man called Lindemann's Christians. He said, "Well, we'll do immediate checks on this man." And they started doing checks for several hours on his background. What they found out, that this Rezzo was betrayed, and every man in it was killed, with one exception, Lindemann Christians. So he said, "Let's look at it. We must immediately go and get an arrest warrant, and we'll go to his camp and arrest this man. We've got to look into him." So they got the warrant, went across to the Dutch headquarters there, you see, and went in, spoke to the duty officer, whatever it is, "We've got a warrant here for a man called Lindemann's Christians. We want to interrogate him." "Oh," I said, "so you can't interrogate him. He's the head of the King Kong Rezzo. He's one of the top patriots in our country." They said, "Nevertheless, we wish to interrogate him." And they said, "No, you will have to have a much more higher arrest warrant than this. And it will have to be with a counter stamp of the Netherlands. You've got a British one. You're in Holland now and you will need this." So he said, "Right, we'll get it." So they left, and it took them a day to get it. Following morning, he went back, Colonel Pinto, with his number two, with a properly filled-in warrant for the arrest. And when they went in, they said, "Well, it's terribly sorry, it's late. He's gone on a mission." Mission was to tell the Germans of the British invasion of Alamein, Operation Market Garden. He betrayed them. Now, years later, I think it was maybe 10 or 15 years later, there was such a kerfuffle in Holland that they were told that Lindemann's Christians, in fact, did not commit suicide and die in the hospital where he was, that they exhumed his body. And he was, in fact, the correct body in the correct grave, Lindemann's Christian. But he was the one that let the Germans know, and they had their reserve units there, as you know. They knew 24 hours beforehand what was going to happen. And there's another interesting, talking about Montgomery. His main intention was to get further in, to meet the Russians as soon as he could, as far away from where they were as they possibly could. But Montgomery, in this case, now, if I had been Montgomery, not anybody, but if I had been Montgomery, if I got every man, when the tanks couldn't get along the roads because it was mud, I'd have given them all rifles, you know what I mean, and I would have sent them. A man who I went to Libya with, he was a private in 6th Airborne Division. He said, "We entrained 5 times to go to the rescue of Arnhem. We had all the aircraft ready. And we entrained, but each time it was cancelled. So we were ready to go and help." In my opinion, we should have gone without any doubt. Landed behind them. If I would have given every tank commander a Sten gun and a rifle and said, "We'll walk." It's only 30 miles to get to those men on those bridges. They held out for all those days, you know, John Frost, for 5 days against panzer tanks, and that was it.